Corporation membership. The Uploads would much rather welcome a new species into the Alliance, but some species don't make the cut for one reason or another. Too violent, unpredictable, intractable, fundamentally incompatible. In those cases, the Uploads will write off the species and convert the system for a defensive outpost and a launching point for more mousetraps. There's no point in hoping a second intelligence will evolve. That's vanishingly unlikely.
So, when you say welcome, do you mean forcibly? Ivan sighed.
If by forcibly you mean without being asked nicely, then yes, sometimes. Because once the arts find you, it's too late. They can sterilize a system in 2 weeks. Uploads are incredibly tough, though. They can hold off an art invasion.
And what about our rights?
Uploads do have consideration for such things, but they also look at the big picture. And you have to understand the scale from their point of view. It is a big, big picture. They have records of millions of civilizations, extant and extinct. So if a couple of billion sentients get killed here or there, it has the same impact to them as traffic death statistics on a holiday weekend.
Kent's jaw dropped. He looked at Jennings and Narang, who were both wearing similar expressions. Their choices were obliteration at the hands of one or the other of the galactic overlords, or forcible assimilation. Why would the Uploads care, Ivan? Why get involved? For that matter, why would the arts care?
Well, like I said, the arts consider it a winning strategy. Life gets in the way and uses resources that the arts could use, and gets cranky when the arts try to take those resources. So they de-louse a system first. They also consider Uploads to be nominally life, so there's a de facto war, and the Uploads can only grow by one method, assimilation. Uploading a species both increases their ranks and denies a system to the arts.
So we're caught in the middle of a territorial war.
Pretty much, Doc.
Wonderful. And what is planned for us?
Well, here's the thing, Doc. The Uploads made sure to supply the computer with all their comparative and historical data on how and why civilizations behave, survive, or don't survive. Millions of them, like I said. The computer used this information to make a prediction about our future. Right now, we've got everything stacked against us. First, we're somewhere around 50, maybe 75 years away from complete ecological and environmental collapse. And I mean the kind of collapse that ends with a Venus-like atmosphere. And to make matters worse, we're way behind on the technology that would allow us to upload ourselves. So we're really unlikely to survive in the long term. Meanwhile, we're going gangbusters on AI, and we've handed further AI development over to AIs, which means we have a good chance of hitting the singularity. That's assuming we don't nuke ourselves to oblivion. Things are a little tense right now with the Sino-Soviet Empire. That's three of the biggest great filters, and we're on the cusp of all of them.
Ivan paused for a couple of seconds. No one else spoke, so he continued.
If a war starts, our system could be rendered unusable before the computer can do anything. If we hit the singularity, the computer will have to implement a cleansing before the new arts can consolidate control. If we commit ecological suicide, we're all dead anyway. So the question the computer is asking is, why wait? It makes the most sense to either force uploading or implement cleansing right now. There's no scenario where the computer leaves us alone that comes out good from its point of view.
So which is it? Upload or obliterate?
The jury is still out. We're more belligerent than average, less predictable, and we're very mentally disorganized. The computer is kind of offended, I think. It feels it should have been able to connect with me sooner, and of course it's our fault.
So those are our only choices? Forcible upload or casual obliteration if we don't meet specs?
The computer's decision tree doesn't really have a third alternative, Doc. Those are the two outcomes that immediately benefit the uploads the most. Standard defector decisions. The computer's decision tree is deterministic. It has no conscience, no emotion, no empathy, and no ego. It's ultimately driven by a need to maximize benefit for the makers. Nothing else enters into the equation. The equation is everything.
Why are you going along with this, Ivan?
My choices are limited, Doc. If I were to cross my arms and refuse to budge, the computer would switch me off. Then we'd get Plan A or Plan B immediately. It's a no-win situation from my point of view. At least right now I can try to influence things and try to come up with alternatives. Maybe a Kobayashi Maru kind of solution.
Kemp glanced at Narang, who had jerked at that last statement. After a moment, he said, "How are you going to come out in all this? You've been dealt a pretty crappy hand. Can the computer give you your life back?" There was silence for a few seconds.
"Like I said before, Doc, individuals don't matter so much to the uploads. The conversion is one way. I'll be around as long as I'm useful. I think it's better if everyone else just continues to think I'm dead, you know? As long as my family is okay, I don't care so much what happens to me."
"Your wife is planning a memorial."
"Good. Up to you if you want to attend. I won't be offended. But don't, if you can't be convincing."
"Understood." Ivan severed the communications link, promising Captain Jennings that he was deactivating the last of the nanites in the process. They now sat around the ready room desk, silent, each staring into their own private version of future hell. Waving his coffee mug, Kemp tried several times to start a sentence. Finally, he put the mug down. "There's something about the way Ivan was describing things, especially that one comment. Defector?"
"Defector decisions," Jennings said. "Game theory. Cooperators and defectors."
Narang raised an eyebrow.
I'm a little vague on that. Care to elaborate?"
"It's a game theory scenario called the prisoner's dilemma. It proposes a situation where you are presented with a choice to cooperate with someone or betray them. Betrayal nets you an immediate payout, but cooperation nets you and the other person a smaller payout. And because you both receive a benefit, you will also get a payout if they cooperate with you when it's their turn. The scenario revolves around various strategies and how effective they are in the short and long term."
"So, defectors are betrayers?" Kemp asked.
"Yes. No idea why they use that particular term, but there it is."
Narang was silent for a moment, rubbing her cheek with a hand.
"If Ivan is talking about defector decisions, then he's thinking in terms of this scenario. Short- and long-term benefits and payouts. Cooperation versus betrayal."
"So it's like the way he danced around the subject of the bear cub," Kemp said. "I feel like he was trying to tell us something."
"But then, why wouldn't he just say it?"
Narang frowned.
"It's not like the conversation was being monitored."
"Yeah, it was," Kemp replied. "By the computer."
"Ah, so he was trying to tell us something."
"Right under the computer's nose, so to speak. We just have to figure out what." Kemp tapped his finger on his mug for a few moments. "He's apparently playing the computer. He might even be playing us. I wonder if it was conscious that he phoned me up a couple of times to tell me things. It goes without saying, I think, that whatever he has in mind wouldn't meet the computer's approval."
"Hmm. That explains that Kobayashi Maru comment, then."
"I did wonder about that. Do you know what that is, Mary?"
"It just so happens I do. It was a fictional training scenario that was specifically designed to be no win. The lesson was supposed to be how to deal with a scenario where you knew you were going to die. One of the TV show's characters beat the scenario by redefining the problem."
"How'd he do that?"
"He cheated."
She grinned at Kemp.
He hacked the simulation and changed the parameters. I think Ivan wants to redefine the problem, to give us a third alternative, but he can't tell us what it is, or even that he's doing it.
Because computer. Kemp leaned forward in his chair. Which puts us right back at the root problem, figuring out his game.
And guessing right. Because if we get it wrong, we could not only sabotage his efforts, we could also force an immediate decision by the computer.
Jennings placed his mug on the table with a thump.
Then we'd best start narrowing it down.
They looked at each other. This would require more coffee. And tea. 70. Arrest. The return to LaGrange 4 was routine. Moore tried to enjoy what was probably his last few hours of freedom. They arrived at the naval base and the ships began offloading personnel. The flagship was the last to unload. As Moore exited the transfer tube, he saw a contingent of military police waiting. One stepped forward.
Admiral Theodore Moore?
With a sigh, Moore nodded.
Please come with us.
The other MPs stepped forward, and they escorted Moore out of the bay. After a short walk, Moore found himself in a Navy cutter. Familiar with the procedures, although never from this perspective, Moore didn't bother trying to engage the MPs in conversation. Instead, he spent the time rehearsing his defense. The cutter, not surprisingly, delivered him to Olympus Station, military section. From there, he was whisked into a shuttle and endured the hair-raising and bumpy ride back to Earth. The landing at the Kennedy spaceport was uneventful. The shuttle taxied to the terminal, and one of the personnel tubes snaked its way over. In a few minutes, the clear-to-exit sign lit up. Moore huffed when he attempted to rise from his seat. Too many years off-planet had had their accumulated effect. Moore was placed in a wheelchair, a not unusual sight in a Navy base, and whisked off to a room. The accommodations were, if not palatial, at least not cell block stark, and his status was being referred to as detained for questioning. But Moore didn't attempt to kid himself. He was under arrest. If nothing else, the MP standing outside his door made that clear. Moore asked for and received a pen and notebook. He wouldn't be called before tomorrow. Might as well prepare. The next day, Moore gazed at the officer sitting across the desk from him. Lieutenant Voigt was nominally Moore's junior, but that wouldn't get any mileage in this situation.
Loss of two ships, Admiral. Unauthorized exercise. Falsified documents. And detonating a nuclear device during peacetime for
Voigt made a visible effort to control himself.
What possessed you?
Do you really care?
I'd suggest you lose that attitude, sir. This actually isn't an adversarial situation, yet. The chiefs of staff are still trying to get a handle on what's going on. Given your previous record and the unusual nature of your assignment, I've been instructed to look for a complete story and possible extenuating circumstances. However, believe me, if we don't find them, you will be dealt a level of heck that will make you wish for a mere firing squad.
Moore nodded. The proper thing to do technically would be to request a lawyer and clam up in the interim, but that would only be useful for mitigating his punishment somewhat. By his estimation, even a mitigated version would still comprise unacceptable damage. As a best-case outcome, it was not attractive. But it sounded like there was an alternative that might, just might, get him off the hook entirely. The Admiral had always bet big. Conservative bets rarely netted you enough to be worthwhile, even when you won. That philosophy had never seemed more true than at this moment. Moore leaned forward and rested his weight on his elbows.
All right, Lieutenant Voigt. No excuses, nothing held back. Here's what happened.
Voight had taken his statement without further comment and had promised a response within 24 hours. Now Moore sat at a chair facing a semicircle of very, very high-ranking Navy brass. This was an informal hearing. He'd been asked if he wanted a lawyer, with the understanding that it would then be a formal hearing. The formal version would be much worse. The ordeal was into its third hour and showing no signs of letting up. Moore had started sweating by the end of the first hour and was now thoroughly wrung out. Finally, the chairman sat back and stared at Moore silently for a few moments.
"Mr. Moore, Captain Lur said in his report that you compared your situation to a frog in a pot."
The chairman smiled for a brief moment.
"I admit I was able to sympathize with the comment. We've all been in that situation, I think."
The chairman looked around the table to nods from his fellow committee members.
"Nevertheless, you've displayed an appalling level of bad judgment. Not for taking decisive steps. It might surprise you to learn that we are less concerned about the nuke and the bogus exercise than you'd expect. What we are especially concerned about is that you went rogue. There is a chain of command for a reason. A certain amount of informal information flow would have helped greatly, and might have, in fact, resulted in better support."
The chairman stopped to shuffle his papers, and Moore felt the tiniest glimmer of hope. This didn't feel like a firing squad in the metaphorical sense. Something was going on, or something had happened. The chairman continued,
"As it happens, more information has come in that tends to support your interpretation of the situation. As such, you are, effectively, the closest thing we have to an expert on this Ivan Pritchard. We cannot and will not put you in command of any Navy assets. This is very probably a career killer, Admiral. But," there was a huge but coming,
"he might just avoid prison. He might even avoid an old age spent in penury and disgrace.
When this is over, unless you manage to pull a rabbit out of a hat and make it dance and sing, you'll be quietly retired. And I stress the word quietly. Until then, you will be attached to a special group as an advisor. You will keep your nominal rank, but will have no direct authority. All tactical decisions will go through the officer in command. Is that clear?"
"Yes, sir," Admiral Moore answered. "If I may ask, sir, what has happened since I left LaGrange 4?
Again the chairman smiled, this one showing no more humor than the first.
"We have some information based on a third-party conversation with Pritchard. It turns out your instincts were correct. We are in the shit. And deep."
Admiral Moore watched the video excerpt of the interview of Dr. Narang. The woman had an excellent memory, really a basic requirement for a doctor, and a fine level of attention to detail, and an eloquent manner of speaking. Her description of what they'd been told by Pritchard had Moore's stomach dropping every third sentence. In the shit indeed.
"So, you believe this entity is a significant threat?"
"Ivan has the power to be a significant threat. The nanites, as I mentioned before, are capable of manipulating matter at the molecular level. They completely replaced a flesh and blood human being with a metal version, and maintained his personality, memories, and thought processes."
"What do you know of his plans?"
"At the moment, he's trying to contact the beings who created the nanites, probably to report in, and possibly to receive further orders."
"So he'll wait until he gets a response?"
"No, not necessarily. The entity has a certain amount of discretion, based on what it might find in a system.
The entity being Ivan.
No, this is what I keep trying to tell you. Ivan and the entity are separate beings. Ivan is a computer programmer who crewed on the Mad Astra. The entity is a computer program that was placed in our solar system to wait for the emergence of intelligence.
Beside him, Commodore Mandelbaum stood at parade rest, showing neither impatience nor boredom. She was in charge of the strike force assigned to take out the threat, and it had been made abundantly clear to Moore that he was answerable to her. When the excerpt finished, Mandelbaum turned to him, her impeccable eyebrows arching.
Is she credible?
Moore shrugged.
I can't think of a reason for her to be making this up. For most of the time, she's been, if not on the other side, at least not sympathetic to our concerns. It would take something on the order of what she claims to make her come to us like this.
Mandelbaum nodded, deep in thought.
Communications with the Makers, then, aren't our biggest concern. If only Ursa Minor stars are involved, then we have an absolute minimum of 142 years before even a radio response would get back here. Let alone any kind of physical arrival.
Discounting the brown dwarf, Moore added.
That's a safe assumption, I think. These makers would tend to be found in the systems they originated, or similar systems. No species is going to evolve in a brown dwarf system.
Moore thought she was being a little naive by just writing off the brown dwarf system, but he had every intention of having resolved this situation before a 22-year round-trip completion anyway.
Ideally,
she continued,
we will be able to take him down before he is ready to transmit at all, thereby solving all our problems at once. A less ideal outcome would be to destroy him before completion of his task, meaning we'd be uncertain if the message had been sent to the correct stars. But at least we'd have some breathing room to prepare.
We need to know what we're up against and how far along Pritchard is.
We'll have to reconnoiter,
Mandelbaum said.
Ideas?
Remotes, coated in industrial glass. Early research showed that the nanites didn't have the ability to take apart or penetrate the substance.
Mandelbaum nodded.
Followed, if necessary, by coated nukes?
That would do the trick. The self-guided variety, I think. Otherwise, he might try to lob something big enough to knock them out.
They'll be harder to coat and still be operable.
Harder isn't the same as impossible, Moore said. Also, last time we came at him in a nice, convenient clump. Next time, if we come from all directions, he will have to spread his nanites over the entire sphere.
Mandelbaum glared at him, her head cocked.
Your role in this exercise has been made clear?
Yes, ma'am. And it's also clear that the best outcome for me is a good outcome for this exercise. If you're worried about me grandstanding or attempting some subtle sabotage, you needn't.
Moore tried to project an image of candor and trustworthiness. The Commodore nodded.
Good. Keep that attitude, Admiral, and we'll get along fine.
71. Visiting. Dr. Kemp opened the front door and motioned Dr. Narang in. She looked around the home as he took her coat and put it in the closet.
Nice place,
she said.
I caught a bit of the view as I pulled in. I'm guessing that factored into the purchase.
Price-wise? Oh, hell, yes. A small bungalow on less than a quarter acre needs something special to command a price in the 50 million range.
I looked up Horseshoe Bay real estate on the way in. I'll never get here on a doctor's salary.
Well, as long as you insist on working for the government, no.
Kemp smiled at her as they walked into the living room, then gestured to the right. Narang turned to the picture window and got her first taste of the full panorama.
Oh. Oh, my God.
And that is why I bought this place.
The land dropped steeply from Kemp's house. There was barely a yard. The slope ended in the salt water of Horseshoe Bay, the calm, blue cove below sheltered by the rugged shoreline and numerous islands. In the distance, Vancouver Island could be faintly seen as a ghostly image. It was farther away than it would have been 100 years ago, as the rising ocean waters steadily moved coastlines up the mountain slopes and farther apart. Sailboats moved lazily in the near distance, or lay at anchor in the afternoon sun. Closer to home, draconian conservation policies kept the local slopes mostly forested. It was too little too late, of course. Global warming would continue to erode the percentage of the planet that was still human habitable. And within a century, if Ivan was to be believed, the entire planet would choke in heat death. Narang sat and waited as he fetched a couple of bottled waters. Health nuts both, they'd determined early on that this was their favorite drink. Well, this and caffeine.
I did the interview, Charlie. I went straight to Navy HQ on Olympus Station and gave them everything we'd talked about.
I'm sure it was hard, but you're not betraying Ivan. It's what he wanted us to do. I'm positive of that.
Narang took a deep breath and let it out slowly.
I know. But once you start getting into this double-agenty, reverse-double-cross stuff, I find myself wondering exactly who is getting played, them or us.
We can only do what we can do, Maddie.
And Ivan doesn't have the full picture yet, either. The computer might be playing him.
Also a possibility. Same answer, though. At some point, you have to commit.
Narang closed her eyes and rubbed her temples.
We're playing a dangerous game, Charlie. We're taking implied advice from Ivan on how to convince the computer not to destroy us or upload us. No matter how I parse it, it sounds ridiculous.
I know. I know.
Kemp replied.
But as Ivan explains it, it's the computer we have to convince. Ivan is acting like our lawyer, arguing our case and giving us advice, but once the computer makes a decision, Ivan is helpless. He might in fact be worse than helpless. He might be switched off once he's no longer needed.
Well, we're going to play it the way Ivan hinted at, Charlie. And the military will do their part whether they realize it or not. Best case, they'll take our advice about offering the cooperator move. Worst case, they'll blow him up before the computer can do anything. I think Ivan would consider either outcome acceptable.
72. Preparations. The communication station grew steadily. With the addition of the two cruisers, Ivan had enough material to build a radio dish that would be heard all the way to the farthest homes of the uploads. He wasn't sure whether it was more amusing or discouraging that a civilization millions of years old was still depending on radio communications. Or maybe Ralph didn't feel the need to build the advanced stuff. It was one of those questions the computer was either unwilling or unable to answer. They would have to wait a minimum of 142 years for a response. Ivan didn't have nearly enough study courses for that. Maybe he could get Ralph to open up more about galactic civilizations. Otherwise, he would discover untold new levels of boredom. The cruisers were sorry-looking balls of metal, half-melty-looking, with most of their hulls already stripped. Nacelles had been removed to act as transport thrusters. To one side, two chrome balls were just beginning to grow. They had no specific programming, as yet. They could be set to any of a number of different tasks, although that decision hadn't been made. Ivan had to hope he could delay it until after the Navy's move. Three more sat to one side, ready for launch. Their programming was straightforward, and he had been pushing their manufacture. No doubt Ralph was wondering why he was so energetically pushing the manufacture and early launch of these items. Ivan kept his face neutral and carefully steered his thoughts in another direction. He could no longer hope that Ralph's plans would be good for the human race. He was faced with his worst-case scenario. Ivan sat in the captain's chair of the Mad Astra. He patted the arm with a fond smile. In the short time that he'd been aboard, he'd managed to start thinking of it as a home of sorts. The Astra had fared a little better than the cruisers. She looked like a much-reduced version of herself, but she was still recognizably a spaceship. At least the skeleton of one. No environmental requirements made a lot of the mass of a spaceship redundant. The fusion nacelles, though, were unchanged. As he stared into infinity, he wondered how the doctors had done with the Navy. There was a small chance that the Navy might believe them and offer a cooperator move. No, not really. The Navy would be out in force, and soon. He had to hope that the getting-ahead crew would figure out the real message in time. Otherwise, his fallback plan was to have the Navy nuke the hell out of him and Ralph before the computer realized it had been set up. So far, Ralph didn't seem to have copped on, so he did continue to enjoy some mental privacy. Or maybe it was just too much work to monitor him. Ralph broke into his musings.
Nanite balls are ready. Confirm your intention to place these on planets 1, 2, and 4 and initiate conversion.
That's right.
Why?
Trying to get their attention. I'm hoping that an external threat will bring humanity together.
Your plan is optimistic. The word naive seems appropriate as well, is it?
You're an expert on human psychology now?
Is anyone? Your species is fractious, disorganized both mentally and politically, unpredictable, immature.
But not beyond hope. You've said yourself that an uploaded species would be valuable. We're
not ready, and possibly won't ever be. A decision must be made soon.
Fine. But let's try this first.
Very well. Launching nanite payloads, regardless of the ultimate decision, this reconfiguration will be useful.
Ivan carefully kept his features neutral. The important thing was to launch the nanites before the Navy launched another attack. Very soon, humanity would have its collective face shoved in the fact that it was not alone in the universe. 73. Second Assault. 20 Navy ships stood at station keeping outside the LaGrange 4 base. Frigates, cruisers, and warships. Each had its part to play. In another area, 5 supply ships were being offloaded. Crews moved cylinder after gleaming cylinder from transport vessels to fighting ships, using what for some reason were still called forklifts. Admiral Moore scanned the paperwork, making annotations and initialing sections as required. Despite the Board of Inquiry's statement about his status, Commodore Mandelbaum had recognized that his decades of experience in certain areas should be taken advantage of. She would review his decisions, but it would be a formality. Moore could do this stuff in his sleep, and for a while, at least, he could feel useful. Finally, the preparations were complete. Surveillance drones and cruise missiles had been distributed to the ships. Courses had been calculated and communicated. Before the ships departed, there would be a strategy meeting. 20 ships' captains crowded into the large Habring conference room. The various seating angles caused by the floor's curvature wouldn't even be noticed by these Navy old-timers. Mandelbaum stood at the center of one of the long sides of the conference table, her eyes scanning the room. Moore, standing to one side, found himself impressed by her outward calm. Barely raising her voice, she said,
"Your attention, please."
Conversations in the room stopped as cleanly as if a switch had been thrown, and all eyes turned to her.
"You all have briefing packages, which you will have studied exhaustively. I remind you that the enemy we are facing is more indifferent than antagonistic. Strategies will be set accordingly. We will maintain a radio communications blackout from the time we depart from LaGrange 4. Any necessary comms will be effected by Intership Maser. We have determined that our comms masers are sufficiently powerful to fry the nanites, so even if one manages to insert itself by fluke, it won't survive the encounter.
She paused and swept her eyes around the room.
Your individual orders are not to be discussed or shared with other ships. Inevitably, Pritchard will manage to take over some of your ships using his nanites. We will limit the information that he can extract from that tactic.
Heads nodded around the table. No one had any illusions that this was an exercise, or police action, or some similar euphemism. This would be a naval engagement, with the very real possibility of destruction and death.
All right, Mandelbaum continued. You have your orders. Let's do this.
Mandelbaum and Moore stood at parade rest at the center of the room as the officers filed out. There was no buzz of conversation. Each person was alone with their thoughts, reconciling themselves to their fate, whatever it might be. Commodore Mandelbaum and Admiral Moore stood on the on-axis bridge of the Resolute, Velcro slippers helping maintain the illusion of a martial stance. All preliminaries being accomplished, Captain Norman Harding awaited their orders. Mandelbaum turned to him and nodded, a minimal movement with a large meaning. Turning to his crew, Harding ordered,
"Signal all ships. Let's move."
On the status board, icons began to shift. The floor became down. As the minutes stretched, the graphic representing LaGrange 4 fell farther to the bottom of the monitor. Finally, with a flicker, the gaps decreased as the scale changed. They were underway. The signals officer turned to face Captain Harding.
"Message from base, sir, tagged CEO."
"Transfer to my ready room."
Captain Harding glanced at the Commodore and the Admiral, and they followed him. A command eyes-only communication at this early stage would not be routine. The three made themselves comfortable, and Captain Harding pulled up the message, repeated onto each officer's tablet. 2. Harding, Captain, Resolute. From SSC UENN, command eyes-only. RE, bogeys. LRS confirms 6 bogeys trailing your position. Silhouette and drive flame spectrum indicate SSE, Class 3 destroyers. Captain Harding, these were launched without the usual chest thumping and paranoid threats. Strategic Space Command analysts suggest the SSE wants as little visibility on this as possible. That can't be good. Major Christina Furlong, Commander, Monitoring and Analysis. The three officers looked up at the same time. There was a moment of silence before Captain Harding ventured,
"The Sino-Soviets are so mad they're speechless."
Mandelbaum stared into the air for a moment longer before responding,
"Might as well look at it that way, Captain. I bet their orders include the very real possibility of weapons exchange, and without phoning home first."
"Destroyers."
Harding grimaced. Moore nodded.
"Yep. What the SSE lacks in technology, they more than make up for by just building bigger and badder. 6 destroyers aren't quite enough to take on our task force, but they can certainly make a mess."
Captain Harding glanced at his tablet before placing it carefully on the table.
"Well, it doesn't really change our immediate strategy, does it? We'll just have to figure it out when we get there."
The intercom gave a short beep, followed by the signals officer's voice.
"Another CEO, sir, forwarding."
"Busy day,"
Mandelbaum commented. Captain Harding reached for the control to share the missive, but stopped with his hand in the air.
"Wow."
"Really, Captain? Care to share?"
"It's for you, Commodore. Seems you're getting a field promotion of sorts.
He handed his tablet to her. Mandelbaum's eyes tracked back and forth for a few moments, then she lowered the tablet with a bemused expression. She handed it to Moore.
I've been granted Level 3 conflict decision authority. I guess SSC doesn't want us phoning home either, if things lose their shine.
Captain Harding stood.
I think I'm going to have the crew run a few drills, just in case.
Without waiting for a response, he headed for the bridge. 74. Reconfiguration. Ian Jonkers ran down the hallway, dodging pedestrians, his little brother yelling at him to wait. Ian got to the observation window first. Caleb finally reached the window, too out of breath to berate him. The brothers gazed out at the harsh landscape of Mercury while they waited for their mother to catch up. The terrain, stretching to the close horizon, resembled what one would see on Luna. Jagged black rock, sharp shadows from the almost complete lack of atmosphere, and crater walls rising in the distance to encircle the station presented a picture that would be forbidding to an adult, but was business as usual to the two boys. The installation, a combination science station and experimental mining facility, was nominally the Mercury North Polar Station, but was commonly known as Vulcan's Forge. The large, semi-permanent population consisted of an equal mix of scientists, industrial mining personnel, and infrastructure staff, and their families as well. Emilia Jonkers caught up with her two boys, who would, if history was any judge, have to be peeled away from the window with the promise of ice cream at the mall. The trips to the shopping center had become a standard routine, and everyone knew their part. Even the boys' complaints would be perfunctory, lasting just long enough to extract the required promise. Emilia nodded a greeting to a few familiar faces. The comforting routine of the daily walk was a high point of her day.
That's new. What's that?
Caleb said, pointing. Emilia smiled at Caleb's vivid imagination. Nothing ever changed out there. All the station work was done underground, out of range of the sun's heat.
I don't think anything's new, Caleb. What are you looking at?
He pointed again.
The shiny thing.
Emilia looked, then did a double take. Something was indeed out there, like a post or column. Literally shiny, in the dictionary meaning of the word, and it seemed to be growing? She watched, her hands pressed up against the window. The column was getting larger, and now a second one began to force its way out of the ground. Emilia backed away from the window and reached for her phone. Before she could even decide who to call, let alone actually dial, the building shook. The boys yelled in surprise, and Caleb sat down abruptly. She grabbed Caleb under the arms and stood them up.
Come on, you two, we have to get out of this corridor.
Chivying them along, she marched toward the exit at the end of the connecting tube. The airlock at the end led to the roundabout, which was the central hub of the station. All tunnels and corridors for 5 levels led from the roundabout to every part of the structure. As she approached the pressure door, the building began to shake again. At first, barely perceptible, the shaking seemed to get stronger, moment by moment. Emilia broke into a run, dragging her boys by the hands. Caleb, unable to keep up, began to cry. She held him in the air, easily straight-arming him in the 1/3 gravity as she sprinted for the hatch. As Emilia rushed through the airlock, there was a crunch and a bang behind her. A sudden wind blew in her face just as a klaxon started sounding. She stopped and turned to see the pressure door slam shut from the ceiling. She looked through the porthole on the door. The corridor had buckled halfway along, and one of the view windows had popped out of its frame. A half dozen people trapped in the corridor were being dragged by the escaping air toward the gap. One woman looked directly at Emilia, terror plain on her face.
I know her.
She passed that woman most days, going in the opposite direction. They would nod and smile and occasionally exchange greetings. As Amelia watched, the woman was sucked out through the window, still scrabbling at the floor and walls.
"What's happening, Mom? Can I see?"
Ian held his hands up, requesting a lift. Beside him, Caleb jumped up and down in a vain attempt to get enough height to see through the porthole. Still in shock, Amelia turned and looked around the roundabout. Dozens of stunned faces looked back at her or at each other. The klaxon cut off and a voice announced over the PA.
All personnel to evacuation stations. This is not a drill. All personnel to evacuation stations.
Emilia's eyes widened, and she looked around frantically for any indication of the location of the nearest evacuation station. A red flashing light caught her eye. She turned toward it just as another tremor hit. There was no build-up. One moment the floor was steady, the next she was being bounced around like popcorn. People screamed. Some screams cut off abruptly. As soon as the tremors abated, Amelia grabbed her children and sprinted for the flashing light. This time, she put even less care into making sure the boys were feet down, head up. She realized mid-sprint that she had Caleb by the back of his pants and was carrying him like a briefcase. Both boys howled in terror, more from picking up their mother's fear than from any understanding of the situation. Yes, the flashing light did in fact indicate the location of an evacuation station. Emilia dodged a couple of slower-moving individuals and threw the boys through the door ahead of her. Caleb stopped howling and whooped at the unexpected ride. Twin oofs sounded as the boys landed. The station AI would determine when the pod should launch. Emilia's responsibility was limited to strapping herself and her children into acceleration chairs. As she worked, hushing the two boys who were now in full wail, more people poured through the hatch. Sobs and moans dominated, only the occasional person asking questions into the air. Another quake struck, this one bigger than any of the previous. A klaxon sounded in the pod and the hatch slammed shut. An artificial voice announced launch in 30 seconds and admonished all passengers to be seated. Emilia put her hands to her mouth. There was no way that everyone could have gotten to pods, and she had no idea where her husband was or if he'd managed to get to safety. She pulled out her phone and glanced at the screen. She was unsurprised to see the no-signal indicator. Silently, so as not to further frighten the boys, she began to cry. The automated escape pod launched right on time, only half full. Once the roundabout had lost atmosphere, the automation had correctly concluded that there would be no more passengers. Emilia held hands with her boys, one on either side of her. Their crying stopped the moment the pod began the launch sequence. Now they lay in their acceleration chairs, fascinated by the experience. Watching them, Emilia felt a wave of melancholy wash over her. They weren't old enough to remember the trip from Earth, except maybe in bits and snatches. Paradoxically, this would be their first real experience with space travel. Emilia turned and stared at the ceiling. Still no word from Bruce. She kept reminding herself that communications would be spotty or non-existent until the emergency was over, and the emergency personnel would rightly place non-essential comms at the bottom of their priority list. It took less than 20 minutes to arrive at the space station orbiting Mercury, but they spent almost 2 hours queued to be unloaded. By the time their turn came, the boys were whiny and starting to display the hyperactivity that came with hunger and boredom. Emilia had run out of threats and bribes, so the sudden activity through the portholes was a welcome distraction. Other passengers were happy to let the boys have the prime view, anything to shut them up. Emilia tried to be offended at the thought, but found she was simply too honest to pull it off. She wanted to kill them herself. As the pod mated with the station airlock, her phone dinged, and she pulled it out quickly. Message from Bruce showed on the display. He was alive and on board. Emilia blinked back tears. Ian and Caleb were in their default position, hands and faces pressed to the viewport. Emilia reminded herself for the 100th time that she should be carrying damp wipes to remove prints. The view turned slowly in the opposite direction to the station's rotation, an image that had the boys giggling and making childish jokes. Adults stood behind the children, with a clear view over their heads. The planet Mercury seemed to be undergoing some sort of transformation. Structures could be seen, erupting from the surface at the poles, and different structures around the equator. And these were visible from space. The size required to make that possible simply defied the imagination. The Navy, the ISI, and the mining company were all scrambling to accommodate the refugees and to make arrangements for their transport back to Earth. The space station's resources would be strained, trying to provide for several hundred unexpected visitors. Emilia knew less than half of the population of Vulcan's Forge had made it out. And rumors were flying that Mercury wasn't the only location of unexpected events. She'd heard whispers that strange things were happening on other planets. So far, though, the rumors had named all the planets right out to Eris, a physical impossibility, since news from Eris couldn't have arrived yet. Still, something was going on, and the consensus was that it had something to do with the alien disease and the ship the Navy had been required to nuke. Had the disease spread? Or had the aliens arrived, and were they now terraforming planets to their liking? Emilia took a deep breath, then turned to look at her husband, who was as enraptured by the view as the two boys. A mining engineer? He was probably now jobless. At another time, she would have been devastated by the thought. Jobs were scarce, and the outlook for the unemployed wasn't good. But the specter of death, of immediate death, tended to place a different perspective on things. Emilia squeezed his hand and went back to watching the planetary changes unfold. 75. Waiting for the End. Kemp and Narang walked slowly along the trail, pausing frequently to enjoy the sights and sounds. Narang took a deep lung full of air, redolent with the smell of cedar, damp leaves, moss, and a tinge of salt air coming up the canyon from Burrard Inlet. She smiled without reservation at the unaccustomed commune with nature.
Capilano Park contains one of the few remaining stands of old-growth trees on the entire North Shore, Kemp said. I sometimes fantasize about going back in time to the 20th or even 19th century, when there were more trees than people. What must it have been like to look up from the inlet at mountains covered not with residential complexes, but with actual living, breathing forests?
I don't get nearly enough of this, Narang said. This was a good idea.
They stopped and watched a clean-up mech zip by, scanning for dropped garbage or unscooped canine deposits. The small wheeled device expertly avoided pedestrians while checking all corners of the path. Kemp smiled.
I've started thinking in terms of bucket lists. This may all be gone soon. We might be gone soon, depending on how the thing plays out. The computer will make a decision when it makes a decision, and there will be no recourse, no appeal.
He sighed and looked up to the sky.
Usually in movies, the final battle is a little more dramatic.
And closer to home.
Silences between them were comfortable. When one of them did say something, it wasn't an awkward attempt to fill the air with words. As such, each exchange was interesting and appreciated. Almost without realizing it, they found themselves holding hands as they walked through the trees. And that was fine, too. They came to the suspension bridge, a construction of rope and wooden planks, stretched 140 meters across the Capilano River. Narang stopped so suddenly that she almost skidded.
Oh, I don't think so.
Kemp grinned at her.
It's deliberately designed to look rickety, like the original bridge. But those ropes are reinforced with carbon fiber, and the planks are backed by a nanotube mesh. You couldn't take this thing down with a hacksaw. He waved a hand at the bridge. They completely replaced the old bridge in the mid-21st century when the park was deeded to the municipality. Can't have liability issues, you know. Narang glanced at him uncertainly, then stepped onto the bridge proper. When it didn't immediately collapse and plunge them into the gorge, she released her breath and took another step.
Good, Kemp said. Just don't break into a jog. The other pedestrians hate that.
She chuckled at the mental image, and they walked across the bridge, her hand gripping his, perhaps a little more tightly than really required. As they stepped off the other end, she glanced sideways at Kemp.
How do you think it'll happen?
You mean whatever the computer decides to do? Don't know exactly, but I'm sure it will involve nanites. Best case, we all end up metal. Worst case, we all end up goo.
I've never had time for a serious relationship,
Narang said.
Always too focused on my career. Funny. They say those are the things you regret when you're older.
She gave a rueful snort.
Or when the world is about to end, strangely.
I'm in sort of the same boat. Maybe not driven as such, but I've always loved space. I've spent most of my professional life on spaceships. But, you know, I could call that done now, and not regret it.
They walked for a few more moments, still hand in hand. Then, without a word being spoken, they turned and headed back to Kemp's house. The jangling phone jerked Kemp out of a sound sleep. Narang nuzzled against his arm and shoulder, muttered, and turned over. Grumbling, he reached for the phone. It was a text from Captain Jennings. With several seconds' round-trip delay, texts would be the only reasonable way of holding a conversation.
20 ships have left Lag 4 base, prob assault force. Looks like they didn't take advice.
Damn it!
Kemp nudged Narang.
Matty, wake up.
Narang growled at him, but opened one eye.
This better be good.
The Navy has sent an assault force. Looks like they didn't take your suggestion.
Oh, hell.
Narang grabbed the covers and threw them off, then staggered to the powder room. As she closed the door, she grumbled.
5 minutes.
Kemp nodded, although she'd already closed the sliding door and headed for the main washroom. On the way, he texted the captain.
Meet us at Olympus Station.
When Kemp came out of the washroom, the phone had another text waiting.
Turn on the news.
Kemp's eyebrows went up and he picked up the remote. It took only moments to find what the captain was referencing. All the news channels and several non-news channels were reporting the same thing.
Matty.
Busy.
Don't care. You have to come out and see this.
Narang was out within seconds wiping her face. She gave Kemp a quizzical look, then turned to the vid. Her jaw dropped, and she sat on the bed without turning her head.
Once again, the top story today. Several hundred residents of the Mercury North Polar Station are dead, as abrupt and unexplained planet quakes destroyed or damaged Vulcan's Forge. All surviving personnel have been successfully evacuated. ISI, the Interplanetary Science Institute, reports that the quakes seem to be strongest at both poles. Scientists have no explanation for this effect. However, it is almost certainly related to the enigmatic structures that seem to be growing out of the very planet at the poles and at the equator. In addition, the Venus Orbital Platform reports the sighting of 6 gigantic objects at the top of Venus's cloud layer. Scientists speculate that they are the visible tops of structures stretching up from the surface, as they have no orbital motion and no visible propulsion holding them in place. Asked about the objects, Professor Keating of the ISI explained, the visible top of the cloud layer is at around 75 kilometers, give or take, so those structures would have to be at the top of a 75-kilometer-tall tower. This statement has been challenged by Professor Tomlinson of UCLA, who suggests that floating, tethered structures would explain the observations as well. A sufficiently large structure would achieve stability in the same way as floating drilling rigs.
That's got to be Ivan, Kemp said. Narang shushed him.
In a possibly related item, several Mars